From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his story in the latest edition of High Country News, Tim Sullivan writes that Polynesians who became members of the Mormon Church traveled thousands of miles to live in Zion. But he notes they left one group of islands only to find themselves in another. In the ethnic islands of Salt Lake City's West Side, Glendale, West Valley, Taylorsville, young Polynesians have found themselves physically and culturally isolated and searching for identity. They find one brand of it in gangs. Today in the program, Tim Sullivan is joining us to talk about his story. It's a profile of Utah's Pacific Island community, how their ethnic culture has converged with Mormon culture and the culture of the street to create a growing gang problem. The Gangs of Zion, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The terrain of Utah couldn't be more different from the islands of the Pacific. And yet, for decades, Polynesians have come to this place, many of them drawn by their devotion to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In his story in the latest edition of High Country News, journalist Tim Sullivan explains the islanders have settled in. They spice up the normally bland Latter-day Saint ward houses with tropical flowers, lava skirts, and sandals. But while the connections between Mormon culture and their own is strong, Sullivan points out that the differences between humid islands and high desert has generated inner turmoil in many of these people, especially among the young. It may help us to understand the growing problem of gang violence within Utah's Pacific Island community. And today in the program, Tim Sullivan is joining us to talk about his story, called The Gangs of Zion. It's about how different cultures have converged to create a unique problem. We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Tim Sullivan. Tim wrote for the Salt Lake Tribune from 2002 until 2003. Since then, he's worked for the Oregonian. He's produced numerous freelance pieces. He's now entering a master's program for city planning at the University of California, Berkeley. His article, The Gangs of Zion, appears in, as we mentioned, the latest issue of the High Country News. And Tim is joining us from Berkeley this morning. Tim, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
Also joining us is J.T. Thomas. J.T. Thomas's photos of the Pacific Islander community in Utah appear with Tim's article. Thomas is a photojournalist based in Colorado and New York City. His projects have included stories on social change within the inner city and in extreme rural areas. He's talking to us by phone. He's on the road in Colorado somewhere. J.T., welcome to you.
Yes, good morning, Doug.
Tim Sullivan, let me begin with you. Do you think that at its heart, this story is about place? Because so much of the story is about identity, and for Pacific Islanders, so much of that is about place. Is place an important dynamic in all of this?
Well, we certainly thought so. That's kind of how we approach the story. In past stuff that I've read about gangs and past stories that I've written about gangs, it's never really entered into it, but you know, when we kind of took the larger view of the story and of Pacific Islanders in Utah, we kept finding kind of more and more connections with place, especially when you have, you know, whole group of people moving from one environment to another environment that was completely different in every way.
JT, how do you think about that idea of place? As a photojournalist, it's probably pretty relevant to you as well.
It's incredibly relevant right now on this story. And it's especially interesting looking at the different generations that have come here and how they identify this, you know, high desert environment that they're living in now, as opposed to, you know, their origins in the Pacific. And then even the younger generations that haven't ever been raised out in the waters of the ocean still have an incredible identity with their culture and transporting that here, at least by imagination.
Tim, how do you describe what your story is about? I mean, what got you thinking about all of this? What did you want to get out of the story? What's the story, I guess, you were essentially trying to tell?
Well, one of my editors at High Country News had run into some, or he had some friends that were members of the LDS Church who had moved to Salt Lake City recently, and they were surprised at the amount of gang violence actually that they ran into in Salt Lake for an area that was supposed to be very family friendly and safe. And so High Country News approached me with that idea, and you know, just to get me thinking. And I thought there were some parallels with the Polynesian community in their experience. So it just kind of snowballed from there. And at the same time, the Polynesians had been kind of doing some soul searching within their community, and had had a gang conference, I think back in February or March, where they were kind of looking at there had been a shooting, a brutal murder about 2 years ago in Park City that the story kind of focuses on. And kind of in the wake of that, they'd been looking at gangs in their community and the generation split and things like that. So everything just kind of came together, and it went from there into issues of identity and issues of place, you know, issues of generation and all these kind of things.
So in a lot of ways, there's this kind of physical isolation, and then there's this kind of internal isolation that's going on. And I wanted you to talk about that in the context of a term that you introduce readers to within the Pacific Island community. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. Fiepalangi?
Fiepalangi, yeah.
Fiepalangi.
It means want to be white, which is a term introduced to me by a guy at Glendale Middle School who was saying, you know, this is what kids are so deathly afraid of is being looked at as being a wannabe white person. And so as a result of that, you know, they're kind of groping toward what it means to be Polynesian. And right now, kind of increasingly, it means, you know, joining a gang when you're in seventh grade.
I want to introduce another voice into the conversation. Joining us here in the studio is Cliff Chase. Cliff is an officer with the West Valley City Police. He's a former detective for the Metro Gang Unit, also a member of the LDS Samoan-speaking Mapusanga Ward. Cliff, welcome. Thanks for being with
Thank
us.
You.
Well, the context for all of this is talking about gang violence. And in your article, Tim, you say that it's worse now than ever. First, Tim and Cliff, give us a sense of that. Well, Cliff, let me start with you, actually. Talk about the problem of gang violence. It's something that's growing, is it?
I think the gang problem has taken on a new face. It's not like the gang culture of old. It's ever changing, and we're finding that many of our younger people are adapting very, very quickly, and they pick up a lot of the attributes of the gang culture before we actually find out what's going on. So it is a problem that's starting to escalate amongst our people. One of the main reasons is because of the closeness of the family. It's easy for family members that are involved in gangs to influence other members of the family.
Tim, you write that Salt Lake City has all of the ingredients to create a gang culture. Talk about that.
Well, it's just like any other city, really, any other growing city, where, you know, you have certain communities that are isolated unto themselves. You have crowded schools. You have families that are, you know, single parents. Basically, all the ingredients in you know, inner city Los Angeles are in Salt Lake City, but on a smaller scale.
There seems like, Cliff, there's a kind of a pattern here. You know, there are Latino gangs, Tim talks about, in Salt Lake, you know, Southeast Asian gangs, and then there are straight edgers, and then there are skinheads, and they all seem to fit this kind of identity pattern. You know, it's about, what, connection. They're looking for a connection?
I think the gang culture amongst the different ethnic groups is basically the same. They've taken the attributes of the gangs that pretty much came to the surface for society in Los Angeles, and they've adopted many of the characteristics from the gangs that were more influential in Los Angeles than any other place, and they've adopted it into their own particular ethnic groups and made their own version of the gang culture.
Yeah. I guess we have to understand history here. To understand how we got to this point, we should understand the history of Pacific Islanders coming here. Tim, in your article, you tell the story of Iosepa. I wondered if you could just explain that, because, again, that history seems important in understanding where we are now.
Yeah, we definitely thought it did. Iosepa is a place out in Skull Valley, which is a few mountain ranges west of Salt Lake City, south of the freeway of I-80. And it's basically a ghost town that was home to started with about 75, mostly Hawaiians, but also other Pacific Islanders that had come to Salt Lake City. The LDS church had been proselytizing in the Pacific Islands actually before it got to Utah, which was something that I thought really surprising. I think the first mission to the Pacific Islands was to Tahiti in 1844. So they'd been there a long time, and a lot of the new members of the church, came along back with some missionaries to Salt Lake City. But for reasons of, from what I understand, you know, there are different accounts of this, but there were cultural differences between, you know, the white saints and the new Polynesian saints, and the church found some land for the Polynesians, and they formed Iosepa, which actually thrived in a lot of respects out there. It's kind of on a hillside above the marshes in Skull Valley. It's a beautiful place. But it was also very difficult because it was such a different environment, and there was a high mortality rate. There was leprosy. They couldn't grow their, you know, traditional crops that they had grown in the tropics, and also, I mean, the main reason was that the church built a temple in Hawaii, yeah. And it actually took a long time for them to get to the temple in Salt Lake City from Skull Valley, so they thought they may as well go back to Hawaii. So they returned, I think it was around 1915 or so, that they returned. And so leaving this, basically a ghost town behind, but there was a cemetery. And so that's pretty much what remains now. But there's a historical society that's really taken care of the place and built a monument and a pavilion. And it's sort of, Cliff can tell you more about this, but it's become kind of a place of pilgrimage for a lot of Polynesians certain times of the year.
JT, as a photographer, when you go to Iosepa to take the pictures, what would you describe it for us? What do you see?
It's probably my favorite kind of environment to go to. I love big, wide open spaces. It's got that vast basin and range feeling to it. Huge space. And to see this tiny little compound now that's going through a kind of a resurrection, kind of ironically, it's a cemetery for sure, but knowing that there's that fella Corey Hupiana who's out there putting a lot of time in to see that it's tended to, working with the historical society, it's got this great feeling of livelihood there as well, especially with all the recently tended to sites there. And when Tim and I visited together on our first visit into Salt Lake and took our drive out there, Corey was actually out there preparing for the first burial that was going to happen in years. I believe it was even the first burial since the 1960s. And it was an amazing little timing on that, and to see all the flags go up proudly of all the different Pacific Islands in this kind of stark environment. And we were there on a day with a looming black cloud. So there was just a lot of energy in the air, and it made it a really interesting place to shoot for sure. And indeed, I would love to go back out there and shoot again, especially with other members of the Polynesian culture from around this, especially the West Valley area, folks that I've gotten to know there.
Cliff Chase, is pilgrimage the right word? Is it a place you return to for meaning in your community?
I'm not sure if it's a pilgrimage as it is identifying yourself with the people of the past. We feel as though that that although they have passed on, there is still a connection between us and the dead. We believe that at some point in time we will meet these people in some other existence. And we want to keep in mind the memories of these people with us, even though many of them we don't know personally. Yeah. We know them through families, through our family members. But it's important for us to keep our ties with them. And this is the way that we do it, is by taking care of the cemetery that is out there. And that's the major reason as to why we go there every year.
There's a very important question, and that is, how do you explain that bond between Polynesian culture and Mormon culture? Cliff, you're quoted in the story as saying this, that the LDS Church has more in harmony with our culture and ways than any other church, and in a sense, we were already Mormons. What do you mean?
Many of the teachings of the LDS Church, especially with along the lines of the importance of family, we had been practicing those kinds of values, the family values that you find in the LDS Church, before they even got there. So it was very, very easy for many Polynesians to accept Mormonism when they first came to the South Pacific. There are some other aspects of the LDS Church which were very similar to our own ancient religions that we found very similar. And our people were drawn to the LDS Church because of this. Many of our elders from ancient times have spoken and saw the future of the arriving of a church that was very similar to the Mormon church when it first arrived. Actually, I'm from New Zealand originally. Mm-hmm. When they first came to New Zealand, many of the characteristics that were described by our ancient people fit many of the characteristics of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it was easy for our people to accept the Mormon religion.
Tim Sullivan, another one of those bonds, it seems, between culture is, you write about, is authority. How does this idea play out in the cultures of Mormonism and Pacific Islanders, and even in gangs now? Because this notion of authority seems to be one of those, converging points in some ways.
Yeah, well, authority definitely is. You know, Polynesian kids learn to obey their parents when they're, you know, at a young age, and there definitely are consequences if they don't. And in the LDS Church, it's the same way. Authority is pretty much the golden rule. But even in addition to authority, it's also a conformity is also kind of an interesting way to look at it, especially when you're talking about gangs, because one thing that I found when I was researching the story was that there would be, with different gangs, you would have different kids. You would have different kids with Polynesian kids, and they would be brought up, you know, to basically play football, to go to church, and there's not a lot of leverage for doing different kind of things there. So when you introduce something so powerful as gangs, there's very little room for individual thought, and I think that makes gangs have a little bit more power. So I think there is a convergence in between gangs and the Mormon culture and Polynesian culture as well, with conformity.
What do you think about that, Cliff?
Growing up in the South Pacific environment, you don't have a choice but to live the kind of life that they have there. You don't have too many outside influences that would be a distraction from the cultural values that we have. Coming here to this kind of setting, especially here in Salt Lake City, you have all different kinds of social scenarios, and our children, as well as many of us that were raised in the South Pacific, are exposed to these social scenarios. Some of us make adjustments and are able to adapt to many of the new ways here, especially the younger generation. And what we're finding is that even though we teach them the traditional values, the cultural values that we have as Polynesians, we're finding that our children are being influenced by the new social values that they're learning here in this country. Therefore, they've been able to change hats, so to speak, depending on what environment that they're in. When they're with their parents, they do whatever their parents want to see. Mm-hmm. When they're with their friends at school, they change to that setting. Whatever setting that they have been influenced by here, they'll make that adaptation to that setting. And it's actually causing a lot of confusion for our younger people. The gang subculture is one that that our people, our younger generation, find very intriguing. They have some of the values of some of our ancient customs along the lines of the Polynesians are basically, they come from a warrior sort of a culture. And many of the values within the gang culture fall along those lines. So they find it easy to accept that or to become involved in the gang culture because of that reason. And they find it very, very exciting.
Well, JT, we don't have you much longer, but I wanted to, one of those physical manifestations of that is some of these tattoos. I just wanted to talk about you to just mention the way you visually portray that, because there's one, actually number of shots of tattoos, and I guess that's the kind of visual way of reflecting. There's something ancient there, and there's something incredibly modern there as well, it seems.
Yeah, there's definitely the blending of all, and certainly from the get-go, even before getting to Salt Lake City, I was trying to imagine what are the most iconic visual cues into the culture, into the religion, into the place, and was on a constant lookout looking for that. I mean, a lot of the stuff, despite gangs being somewhat subversive and in the shadows, the different gang symbols, the tattoos, there's a lot of things that are very, I'd almost say pretentious, deliberately so. And I was on the constant lookout for those, and it was a learning curve as well to figure out what stuff was traditional, what stuff was contemporary, what stuff may have been just a spur-of-the-moment tattoo with some buddies on a Saturday night that really didn't have any relevance, to any that didn't smack of the tradition or of the gangs themselves. So it was tough to figure that all out. But yes, absolutely, especially, this is radio, so I can only describe the cover image, which is a tattoo on this fellow's back, and he was a former gang member, and it's of an island, and a kind of a Neptune type of character fighting a shark. And to see that, to take that in some ways, which seemed very almost ordinary because I'd seen so many tattoos around, and I started thinking about it, how unique it was, really, that it had become the ordinary had become extraordinary in this terrain of Salt Lake City. That was definitely kind of my window into the meshing of the cultures and the religion and the physical environment that everybody's living in there in Salt Lake.
J.T. Thomas, his photos of the Pacific Islander community in Utah appear in Tim Sullivan's article in the latest issue of High Country News. It's called The Gangs of Zion. JT, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Tim Sullivan is with us. He, of course, wrote the article. Also here is Cliff Chase, an officer with the West Valley City Police. We invite you to join us. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, journalist Tim Sullivan is joining us talking about his story in the latest issue of High Country News. Sullivan explores how the culture of street gangs in Utah somehow meshed with the culture of young Polynesians in this state. Utah is one of the largest Pacific Islander communities in the United States. Most are drawn here by the Mormon Church, which is another intriguing part of the story. Sullivan says the gangs that these young people join are often the result of a search for identity. Tim Sullivan is joining us from Berkeley, California today. Also with us is Cliff Chase, an officer with the West Valley City Police, a former detective for the Metro Gang Unit. He's also a member of the LDS Samoan-speaking Mapusanga Ward. And we invite you to join us. 585-WEST is that number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to ask both of you about, there's the physical sense of isolation. One thing you write in the article is that Yosepa revealed was that Zion's many tribes, as you write, don't settle together so seamlessly, and that this harsh change generated this kind of inner turmoil. And you say that young people, Cliff and Tim, I want you to both mention this. Tim, you say they call it the beast, this notion of anger that they have. It maybe is a reflection of this sense of inner turmoil. Explain that, if you would.
Well, this was a term that was introduced to me by a gang member. And I don't know if every single gang member refers to it this way, but the beast is the anger that prompts a lot of the gang violence. And the way it was explained was Miles Kinney, who was a former gang member with the Tongan Crip gang, saying, we call it the beast, and it's when it's family, we squash the beast. And a lot of this anger can be generated, by this kind of inner turmoil at home when you're growing up, within violence within the home, which is corporal punishment by parents. Cliff can talk more about this, is part of Polynesian culture. And it's something that's not as much part of the culture in Utah, in mainstream Utah culture. And that difference has created a lot of anger within a lot of the young Polynesians that I talk to. And from what I understood, it just kind of starts bubbling and kind of gurgles up in the form of incredible anger and violence that I've heard they've called the beast. You try to squash the beast, but the beast keeps coming back.
Cliff, how do you see it? What's that connection between culture and violence?
I think, the setting in the South Pacific is much different than it is here. Although we hear about the violence in the families, many of the situations will be considered to be domestic violence related. I have to mention on the other side of the coin, they have seem to balance it out with this great bond that they have with each other, this great love that they have with each other. Although they may be physically disciplined, and sometimes the beatings parents give their kids is very brutal. But in the setting in the South Pacific, they have this way of expressing a love for a family member, which leaves no doubt in that that family member's mind that his family still loves him, even though he gets a beating. When you bring that kind of cultural practice here, yeah, in this setting here, you have a whole total different kinds of values here, and therefore they kind of look at things a little differently here. The kids, they see their friends who are not of their ethnic group, yeah, being treated differently when they do things wrong, and then they feel a certain amount of resentment towards their parents because here their white friends are not being disciplined like them,
yeah,
and this is something that builds up with inside of them. Therefore, they look for a release somehow. And some of them have found that release by becoming members of a gang or starting their own gangs and taking out their frustrations on those that oppose them. And that's what we're seeing here.
You know, it's interesting, Tim, you write about the fact that, you know, there's a kind of a system that they've developed. It's a kind of a system of justice. And so in one place, on, you know, in an island, in a village, it works. This I think you describe it, it's the fa'a matai. Did, mm-hmm, I get that? Did I say that right? This notion of finding a solution, you know, with mutual respect and forgiveness and all of that. That's part of the old system, but that doesn't work very well here.
Well, the saddest thing for me was seeing how strong these Polynesian families were. I mean, just fantastic families that anyone could really hope to have, and you see that bond, you know, that Cliff describes, you know, in the islands, which, you know, a lot of the gang members that I talked to said, God, you know, I had great parents, you know, they had fantastic parents, and they did a great job, and I loved, you know, I liked going to church with my family. But when it came down to it, the gangs were more important because they would, you know, they would live this double life and basically carry on behind their parents' back. And when it, you know, came down to it, you know, being with the boys was more important than being with the family, because they would continue to do it and it would continue to harm their family. And maybe the most sinister thing is that this family allegiance has sort of been manipulated into gang allegiance, because like Cliff said, you know, taking these family ties and turned them in, you know, and used them to keep growing the gangs. And so when you have when you're a child, you know, you're 10 or you're 12, and all you see. And it's the generations are building up now. We're on, like, you know, the third generation.
Yeah.
And you see these uncles that have been involved in the Tonkin Crip gang or the Regulators, and you see your cousins that are involved in it. You know, what are you going to think when everyone's telling you that family is the most important thing, and you see that family is so intermixed with gangs, and at the same time, you know, family members are killing each other. It doesn't make any sense.
Tim writes, Cliff, that, yeah, forgiveness gives way to vengeance, whereas before it had been there had been this sort of reconciliation that went on after a beating, you know, there was this expression of love, and that old way is hard to adapt, I guess, here or outside of that environment.
Yes, it's very hard for them to make that adjustment here. The parents have grown up with many of the cultural values that that have been ingrained into them, and they've tried to pass it on to their children in this setting, but it's not working. And I think there's a great amount of confusion upon the Polynesian community as a whole because of this particular problem. How do you blend the old with the new? And it's very difficult for them to come up with solutions to that particular problem that they're experiencing. I can only say that it's something that we as a community are working on we feel is that culture is still very, very important in our children's lives, even though they're born and raised here. We feel as though that identity is one of the most important aspects of our culture, and to know who you are is to empower you, and that's the way we feel. That's the reason why we have to continue to try to help our younger generation understand the culture, so that they know who they are and where they came from.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's go to the phones. Richard has been waiting in Salt Lake. Richard, welcome.
Hi. Hi, Doug, and hi, Officer Chase. My name is Richard Wolfgram, and I am a publisher of the Onomashima News, which is a Pacific Island publication here in Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yeah.
We wrote an article last month. Actually, I just wrote in my column, and the article was entitled Most Tongan gangbangers in Utah come from LDS homes. And so we kind of explored this theme that Tim wrote this great article about. And I wanted to just call in and clarify a few things. I think anytime you're talking about Polynesians, you have to be careful because within Polynesian communities, we're also very diverse. You have your Tongans, of course, and then you have Samoans, Hawaiians. We have a few Maoris and a few Tahitians that live here in the Salt Lake Valley, and Yosepa, you know, was a Hawaiian colony pretty much. And so for a lot of us Tongans, we don't have that connection to Yosepa that that you're talking about, and that was also mentioned in the article. So I wanted to clarify that. But one of the things that came out of my column is it really identified that the generations, as far as myself, I consider myself a Tongan American, and the older generation, which would be the first or second generation immigrants, were really polarized in the way that they reacted to the article. Some felt that it was an attack on the LDS church, and so they tried to turn it to that kind of an issue, whereas the younger generation really resonated with what I had to say, and pretty much what I said is that we have a gang problem within our LDS community, and I'm LDS myself, and I didn't name a lot of names like Tim did, mostly because for my own safety, and also because we are such a small community, I pretty much knew every name that was mentioned in Tim's article. I pretty much know almost every one of those names and every one of those families, and so that shows you how tight-knit and how interweaved we are as a community, and so my article just pretty much talked about my own personal experiences, and I've been to LDS ward functions where there were shootings. I've seen a fight at Temple Square, and so I really felt like we needed to address this issue. But going back to what I said earlier, the generations, the older generation really took it hard, and we're still having a lot of discussions over it, but they totally felt that I was fabricating things, and it just shows that they're really not connected with the issues that are important to us as third or fourth generation Tongan Americans who have grown here in America, and we pretty much are trying to figure out where we fit in the system and in the scheme of things, and we're constantly, you know, balancing the two worlds, which goes back to issues of cultural identity as well. So,
do you think in some ways that because Tim talks about this and writes about this in his article, this idea that there is a kind of – there's a sense of denial in some way. A lot of parents were surprised and shocked by the fact that their kids were involved in that. And even when they did sort of have a sense that it was going on, there was a kind of denial. Do you see that kind of denial within that community?
Yes. As far as reactions to the column that I wrote, and not to steal Tim Sullivan's thunder, but – a lot of the parents, a lot of the feedback that we got back, it was a lot of denial. A lot of parents, which Tim mentioned in his article, are still in denial of what their kids do. But we, you know, the younger generation, we know who they are because we see them. And they're not ashamed to pull out a gun in broad daylight and just start shooting. So we know who they are. And when you mention it to parents, a lot of them are protective. I know that some parents won't even volunteer information to the police because they want to protect their children or they want to protect their family honor or whatever. And so that's also an issue as well. I think another important thing to add is generations, I think our generation, our parents, we need to communicate. I think that was something that was touched upon. But it's such an important issue, lack of communication between the generations.
Richard, we're glad you called.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. 585 West is that number again, 585-9378. Well, Cliff, I wanted to ask you about this because in Tim's article, he introduces us to a character, Issa Tausinga. Did I get the name right?
Issi Tausinga.
Forgive me, Tausinga. And he was one of the first, I guess the first really within that community, the Polynesian community, who was involved in law enforcement. And he went through an incredibly difficult time. And you, I guess you're the second, really. I wonder what you went through, because Issi was, Tim describes that he was resented by younger Polynesians and even older ones who didn't want to see what, in fact, they were really seeing. He was whitewashed, was the term. What did you go through? Talk about that, if you would.
Maybe I can just touch on, give you an idea of what Issi Tausinga went through. Basically, he was rejected by his community. And it got so bad where Salt Lake City actually had to post security at his house to ensure the safety of himself and his family. That's how bad it got for him. Because of all the work that he had done in trying to expose the gang problem in the Polynesian community. Because of his work, because of everything that he did when he was assigned to the Metro Gang Unit, he was one of the original detectives assigned to that unit. I actually benefited from much of the work that he did. I didn't experience many of the rejections that he had experienced. I think that by the time I had, I was assigned to the Salt Lake Area Gang Project, most of the Polynesian community members were aware of the gang problem that was prevalent in the Polynesian community. I still had problems with different individuals and different families within the Polynesian community when I had to deal with their children. But for the most part, I think I saw that the attitude was changing and that people within our own community were starting to realize the magnitude of the problem that we were having. I think the one thing about them is that they just didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to deal with the gang problem within our community. And we've actually come a long way since I've left the unit. Right now, it was mentioned about the gang conference, the community gang conference, yeah, for the Polynesian community that we had in the first part of the year. It was a great success. I think many of the people that attended had their eyes opened to many of the problems that we've been experiencing that they didn't realize that we had. And I felt that they wanted to do something. For the very first time since I've been working with our Polynesian community, this was the one time that I felt as though that the general members of our community really wanted to do something about it. So we've actually come a long, long way from the days of Issi Tausinga up until this point in time.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's go back to the phones. Malo is joining us from Salt Lake. Hi, Malo.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Talo falabo,
Salt.
Malo. I served an LDS mission in Samoa some 25 years ago and returned and taught in a missionary training center for about 5 years. Wrote the books, helped write the books, the cultural manuals, met thousands of Samoans, Tongans. And after I left BYU, I did a a cultural study that involved going down to Los Angeles to the Long Beach area and living with gangs. I lived with gangs for an entire summer. And also here in Salt Lake in the Rose Park area. And I know all you folks. I'll tell you, I've got a perspective on this entire problem I don't believe has ever been mentioned. And I've witnessed it. And this is the dynamic I'd like to express. When I lived with Samoan gang members in 1975, they made their living selling marijuana, which they said to me, and I believe it, it is no different from ava, the kava drink that they drink in Samoa. It doesn't do any more harm than ava. So they didn't believe that it was wrong, and yet people who bought their marijuana from them supplied the gang with their money. 10 years later, it moved from marijuana to crack cocaine. 10 years later, 1995, it was meth, and that's where it is today. And I suggest that as with the gangster problem we had, the mobsters of prohibition, it is prohibition, the prohibition dynamic. And if you follow the tupe, the money, you will find that that's exactly what keeps the gangs in business. And as long as we have prohibition, we will have gangs. And that's my opinion.
Glad you shared it, Malu. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
585 West again is that number. Cliff or Tim, anyone want to? You didn't really get into that in the article, Tim. Do you want to say anything about that, or Cliff?
Well, we definitely do have gangs and drugs. They go hand in hand. We didn't really touch on it. Or wasn't touched on it within the article. But we're finding that many of our Polynesian gang members are involved in drug trafficking. We've had intel information that some of the connections that they have are from larger organizations from out of the state, mainly from California. They deal in cocaine and methamphetamines. The one thing about our Polynesian gang members, they've been able to build alliances with other ethnic gangs for the purpose of building a monetary base. We've found that just recently I had a young man that I was part of his arrest, where he was an enforcer for a white supremacist gang. And the only reason why they're able to do this is because of the drug trafficking and drug business that they're able to generate by using each other's resources and bringing it together. Yeah, so there is a big, big problem with drugs in gangs, especially with Polynesian gangs at this point in time.
Tim, there's that other. Go ahead.
The way it's been described to me is that the gang culture has completely changed from, say, 10 or 15 years ago. Whereas, you know, in early 90s, I actually used to play baseball in the West Side, and when I was a kid, and when I was a teenager, and in say Sherwood Park, which is like 4th South, almost like 14th West, the gang, colors were so visible. You know, it'd be red and blue everywhere. People on the back stop, people getting stabbed, the snack bar getting tagged. And this was pretty much common all over the West Side, and, to some extent later on in West Valley City, where people would be, it'd be like colors, a movie, people flashing their signs and stuff. But you don't see that anymore. As of the late 90s, it became more about a business. It went underground, so to speak. But it got way more serious. Like Cliff was saying, connections to larger cartels, connections between different gangs for business purposes. Like he says, Polynesians are often enforcers for, say, like the Tiny Oriental Posse, or another Asian gang. But still, I don't think that legalizing drugs would solve it, because I still don't believe that that's really the heart of why kids join gangs, because it's a business. I think there's way more wound up in it than that still.
I'd like to add one more thing to this, is that I find that the majority of the Polynesian kids that are involved in gangs are pretty much imitating the gang, what they see, how they see the gang culture being projected as they see it through the media, yeah. Through, you know, what they see in the music industry. And they pretty much try to imitate that more than anything else, I'm finding. You find very, very few Polynesian gang members are in it for the money, in it for business. For one thing, I'm not sure if they have enough business skills to be able to operate a drug business. So I think for the most part, they're just going through the motions. They're just imitating.
Well, and there's a lot of allure in that culture too. I mean, you know, it's the whole, you know, gangster life thing. You know, gangster rap. It's just such a alluring culture for a kid, any kid really. I mean, you walk into the Metro Gang Unit and you see the different detectives with you know gang decorations on their desks, which you know they may be tongue in cheek, but still, you know, there's. It's just a really alluring culture to anyone, really.
585 West is the number to join us. Time, I think, for one more. Not much, though. Anna Pisi in Salt Lake, welcome.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. One of the things that I wanted to bring up is that, and thank you for bringing this issue out into the public, but I think that it's important for us to be able to view this, the complexity of these issues from a variety of different multiple perspectives. And I think one that was missing that I didn't really see in the article is how this all fits within the larger system of power. And I think it's important to recognize that Tongans, because you talk a lot about Tongans and Samoans whose migration to Utah didn't begin until the late 50s and 60s. And so when you're looking at the profile of these kids and parents being there, I think it's also important to look at the financial stability, that a lot of parents are working two or three jobs just to survive, and so the supervision at the home is not the same. And many of these kids come from homes where parents don't speak English, speak very little English, and so there's a language problem that's happening there. Not a problem, but I mean there's the language barrier that's there. And also that these kids are coming from schools. I work closely with a lot of these youth, and they feel very displaced at school. And so they're coming from, so they bought into a lot of these stereotypes. And so when we're talking about Fiat Balangi, and for those who are being educated and how education and being educated becomes synonymous with being white, I think it's important for us to look at how these kids have bought into these stereotypes and how can they come to know themselves in a society that labels them according to these stereotypes. And so there's definitely those issues of identity, but I think it's much more than just looking at what the Pacific Island culture is here. I think it's important for us to put it in a context within a state that's predominantly white, a state that where other cultures, other ethnic cultures are very much displaced, and they're trying to find their place within that. And that's why gangs, I think, in many ways become such a influence for them, because it's where they feel safe. It's where they feel this kind of stability that they're not getting elsewhere, not in the schools. And even though parents are trying in their homes, they're also dealing with a lot of other dynamics that I think wasn't brought up in this article.
We're so glad you called. Thanks very much. Great points. Let me ask finally, less than a minute. So, Cliff Chase, let me give you the last word. How is the community thinking about that? You talked about that there's a real concern within the community. How do you foster individuality in a community that's so connected to, you know, something that's not necessarily individual? I mean, what's I guess, the final thing that you're thinking about then? Then there's less than a minute, so forgive me. But how's the community thinking about it in that sense?
Just this past week, we had what we call a fireside and involving the parents and the youth of one of the Tongan stakes. And we talked about law enforcement issues. One of them was gangs, which I touched on briefly. I think that both the older generation and the younger generation have to work together. We can't deal with this problem without each other. Some people want to work with just youth to try to resolve the problem, but you can't do it without the parents. And I think that's the basically the route that we have to go. We have to work together as parents and as kids to deal with this problem. We have to understand the magnitude of the problem and how it's infiltrated our community. I think it's important to also to keep in mind that if we don't, as a community, stamp this problem out of our community, it'll literally destroy us as a people. We'll lose our identity. We'll lose our cultural values. We'll lose everything that makes Polynesians Polynesian. That's why it's so important for us to address this particular issue at this point in time.
This is something that's really close to you. You said you still have you've been dealing this with for so long, but when you look at the kids, you were saying off the air, this is still something that really gets at you.
It does. It does, because I can see the ultimate result if we don't deal with it. We're going to lose everything that that makes us who we are. And it's so important for us to be able to identify ourselves as Polynesian.
Tim Sullivan, time for one last word from you. A lot at stake here, clearly, when you talk to Cliff Chase. Do you get a sense that there's a kind of hopefulness within that community?
I do, definitely. In talking to a lot of young people who have found other ways to express themselves, and a lot of what actually JT, I wish JT was here to talk about this, but he found a lot of young Polynesian Americans making music, including former gang members, and that's actually a pretty vibrant scene in Salt Lake right now. You wouldn't think it, but. I talked to a guy who takes kids snowboarding to show, look, there's a lot to do here. There's a lot of different people you can be. They're emerging Polynesian American role models in politics. What the last caller said, I think, is a really great point. You look at the power structure, and just to give kids hope that, there are so many different paths you can go to. You don't have to be in prison, by the time, or dead by the time you're, 25 or whatever, 20. There are just so many different things you can do, and it's about taking kids out of that environment sometimes, and just showing them the different alternatives.
Tim Sullivan, he's the author of the article "The Gangs of Zion," which appears in the latest issue of High Country News. He joined us from UC Berkeley. Tim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
And Cliff Chase, an officer with the West Valley City Police. Cliff, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Mariel Hennig. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.